Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Irish Studies. This is your host, Ryan Shelton, and today it's my great pleasure to be joined by Dr. Francis M. Carroll. He's the author of America and the Making of an Independent Ireland, published in 2021 by the New York University Press. It's part of their Gluckman Irish Diaspora series. Dr. Carroll, thanks so much for joining us and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. This is a great pleasure.
Well, this is going to be a really fun conversation. I'm so excited to get into it. But first, I wonder if you would tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm an historian at the University of Manitoba, Professor Emeritus. I was hired as the U.S. diplomatic historian, and that was my introduction to all of this. My original intention was to try to figure out how the Irish question obstructed close Anglo-American relations in the early 20th century. And I went off to Trinity College Dublin to do a PhD on that subject. And it's occupied me ever since. That was back in the 1960s.
Oh, that's wonderful. So this book, America and the Making of an Independent Ireland, it's just come out as part of this new series by the New York University Press. What led you to be interested in the specific topics that you cover here? And I guess, what's the story behind this particular book?
Well, it's on one level, it's an outgrowth of that old PhD thesis, which was written 50 years ago. In fact, I was in Ireland during the 50-year anniversary of 1916, but I was invited to the New York University Irish Studies Program, Glucksman Ireland House, to participate in their centenary of 19 celebration of 1916. And I was so struck by how strongly they asserted the U.S. role in 1916. The then director, Joe Lee, had the wonderful remark, no America, no New York, no 1916.
Wow.
which pushed the idea quite substantially. So I, given the writing that I'd done since the first book, and given the opening up of documents and the availability, the ready availability of material on the internet or through photocopying, I decided to rework much of what I had written in that original book and expand it into the 1920s, which I had done in articles, but never under two covers. So I really had a lot of fun putting this together and emphasizing the role both of the Irish American community and subsequently of the American government as well. I think the role of the U.S. government has been really underrated. So I hope I've drawn attention to the fact that both during the First World War and in the 1920s, the U.S. government was very willing to give its support to the notion of Irish self-government and to the notion of diplomatic recognition in the 1920s.
You've mentioned the Irish-American population that plays such an important part in this story. I was struck by some of the figures that you gave early in the book of the Irish diaspora in the U.S. Can you just give us a sense of just the scope and scale of what kind of population we're talking about here?
Well, it was really quite substantial. The migration from Ireland, from the Great Famine, from the 1840s, right up into the early 20th century, was substantial. So that between, say, 1910 and 1920, the census years, the number of Irish-born people, citizens in the United States, and their children ran to somewhere between 4 and 5 million. And the number of third and fourth generation Americans of Irish descent was upwards of 20 or 21 million, which was a substantial portion of the United States, made all the more relevant by the almost unique way in which the Irish American community had taken a very prominent role in local politics. They were a political force. So the U.S. government, and to some extent the British government, had to really take into account what the power, the potential power anyway, of this community was in shaping U.S. policy.
So 20 million or so people, I think you said that something like almost 20% of the U.S. population at this time?
That's correct. The U.S. population is about 90 million. If I remember correctly, but in 1920, so that 20 million was a big chunk of that total number.
That's fascinating.
Not all of them were involved in Irish American activities, but the potential there was really significant.
So much of what we now think of as this making of an independent Ireland is this event called the Easter Rising. So what is the Easter Rising, and how did public opinion of this, especially this Irish diaspora in the U.S., understand what was going on?
Well, it's an incredible and rather improbable story. Up until the First World War, of course, the major effort in the United States was among the Irish community was to support the Home Rule Party, which would theoretically provide or ideally provide self-government within the British Empire, home rule. But home rule was seriously resisted by unionists throughout Ireland, particularly in the north. And the unionists constituted a major portion of the Conservative Party. So it was very difficult in these circumstances for the government to actually just pass legislation and put home rule into place. And then the First World War broke out. So everything was suspended. The Home Rule Bill was passed, but not enacted. And things were in suspension. And among the Republican element in the United States, which was very small at this time, they began to work with the United Irishmen or the United Brotherhood in Ireland to mount a rebellion within the war, and hopefully from their point in alliance with Germany, or support at least from Germany. And you'll remember that Sir Roger Casement went to Germany in disguise and tried to raise an Irish regiment within the captured prisoners and to negotiate a relationship with Germany to support a rebellion. And by 1916, with a lot of support from this Republican community in the United States, the Clan na Gael, with money and with all kinds of verbal support, the 1916 rebellion took place. Now, everybody in the or large numbers of people, in any case, within the Irish communities in the United States and in Ireland, regarded that as a betrayal of the Home Rule Party and the Irish Parliamentary Party and the whole direction of Ireland prior to the First World War. But the British execution of the leaders of the 1916 rebellion really began to change opinion, both in Ireland and in the United States. The argument being, if they were prisoners of war, they should be classified as such and put in prisoner of war camps. And if they were civilians, they should go before a civil trial. And instead, they were executed by an army tribunal. And so opinion began to shift after 1916 in support of a stronger sense of independence rather than home rule. That had growing strength, what became the Sinn Féin movement. Now, Sinn Féin preceded all of this, but it was the agency in Ireland which picked up after the 1916 rebellion.
You've mentioned that World War One is happening, at least on the European continent, when all of this is beginning to take place. America has not yet entered this conflict, at least not formally. And then when America is now about to enter and join the Allied forces, there's some negotiations that are starting to happen between the U.S. and the British government that's revolved around the Irish question, right, about their involvement with this military conflict. How is Ireland starting to shape America's involvement in World War One?
Well, it's a very interesting procedure in which first Woodrow Wilson instructs the U.S. ambassador in London to approach Lloyd George, who had within the previous 6 months formed a coalition government, that to facilitate close cooperation between the United States and Britain in the war, it would be of enormous assistance to resolve this Irish question, to give the Irish some form of self-government so that the anti-British agitation in the United States would be undercut in some way. And when A.J. Balfour, the foreign secretary, visited the United States in the summer of 1917 to work out the details of coordinating the war effort, Secretary of State Lansing had him for a private conversation to make the same point that the resolution of this unresolved Irish self-government question would facilitate close U.S.-British relations in the war. And the failure to do that just created all sorts of problems for the U.S. government, which of course actually unfolded. So here was both the president and the secretary of state trying to reach the British government to get some progress on this solution. And the Irish Convention of 1917-18, in summary, set up at Lloyd George's organization, attempted to do that, but it did not reach a conclusion that allowed the government to implement any form of self-government. So throughout the war, this issue remained a sore point right up until the armistice.
Well, speaking of the armistice, you've talked a bit about the German involvement in some of the early parts of this Irish uprising, and this now becomes a major point, or you could say a thorn, in some of Wilson's efforts to get the Treaty of Versailles and his dreams for this League of Nations to receive popular support back at home. How does that dynamic play out?
Well, it's an interesting sort of complication, seemingly unrelated to the issues that Wilson is trying to resolve at the peace conference. But one way that the Irish American community and the Irish community itself could reconcile itself to the war effort was Wilson's assertion that the war must guarantee the rights of small nations and the right to self-determination. Every country had the right to live under a government of its own choice. And this was articulated in a number of ways. And both the nationalist community in Ireland and the Irish American community rallied behind that kind of assertion. So that when the peace conference started, the Irish felt that Ireland should be brought before the peace conference, the British Parliament having failed to resolve the question from 1914 to 1918, the peace conference should be the settlement. And of course, the peace conference really focused on Germany and Austria and didn't embrace any other countries. And the result was certainly the Irish American community, and I dare say elements of the Irish community as well, felt betrayed. They'd been promised, in a manner of speaking, self-determination. This was what the war was being fought for. And yet they didn't qualify at the Versailles Conference. So within the United States, anyway, a lot of the resistance to the signing of the Versailles Treaty and U.S. membership in the League of Nations was obstructed by angry Irish Americans who felt that this was not the peace treaty and the solution to the war that they'd been promised. Mm. Now, there were other elements certainly that contributed to the defeat of the League of Nations, but the Irish obstruction was a major element.
Well, there's this long kind of post-war period that your book starts to cover, you know, into the 20s, which is some of the new material that you mentioned at the start of our conversation. Public opinion is starting to be shaped by this commission that's set up. There's also a staggering kind of maneuver to raise financial support. So I wonder what's going on in this post-war period that's forging a new kind of relationship between America and this new government trying to sort itself out.
Well, it's a very interesting procedure in which the Irish American community, to assist the new Doyle-Aaron government, created in January of 1919 as a result of the general election in the United Kingdom in December, which brought a huge majority of Sinn Féin representatives who refused to take their seat in Parliament in Westminster and met in as the Doyle-Aaron and declared independence. And the Irish American community jumped forward to support that movement, and they used the language and the imagery of the First World War. The United States raised money for the war by the sale of Liberty Bonds, and the Irish American community supported the Doyle-Aaron government by selling bond certificates. The anti-German and anti-Central Powers publicity was generated by the Bryce commissions on atrocities in Belgium and the Turkish atrocities in the among the Armenian community in Asia Minor. And so an American commission on conditions in Ireland, led by not by Irish Americans, but by a kind of old line liberal Americans. And then enormous amounts of money were raised for relief. Here again, like Hoover's relief in Belgium and subsequently in Eastern Europe, the American Committee for Relief in Ireland raised about $5 million, just over $5 million, with the support of the new president, Warren G. Harding. So here again, the federal government became involved, at least tangentially, in this process. So all together, and the bond certificates raised over $5,600,000, which was about two-thirds of the Doyle's revenue. So it really helped to keep the Doyle functioning in 1920 and 21. It was a major source of income. Now, how much pressure that put on the British is hard to say, but it was clearly an element in their thinking that this situation is deteriorating rather than coming to a resolution. Clearly, the Irish and the Irish American community were not going to accept a return to status quo. So it was a huge effort. And it did involve the U.S. government at several levels, which is really quite interesting.
Well, throughout this book, which obviously, as the title even suggests, the primary theme is the relationship between America, the U.S., and a new independent Ireland. There's this kind of counter melody that as American friendship with Ireland is growing, it's often at the expense of American-British relations. And there's this episode that I think illustrates what's at stake really well, and that's this visit that the Secretary of State, Frank Kellogg, takes to Europe, and he snubs the British and decides to go to the new Irish Free State instead. What's going on in this story?
Well, that is a really fascinating episode, and I'm so surprised that other historians haven't picked up on this. It gets a mention, it gets a line or two, but the kind of public relations element of this is really enormous. The Kellogg-Briand Pact was one of the major events in the interwar years. Historians are still debating as to whether the outlawry of war was in any way effective, or whether it was just a wishful statement. But at the time, it was regarded as a major, major event, and Kellogg had arranged to go over to Paris to together with Briand to sign the pact and a whole number of European powers, including the Irish Free State, were invited to sign the pact also. And in the context of William Cosgrave's visit to the United States earlier in the year, Cosgrave had invited Kellogg to come to visit Ireland, which was a nice, polite gesture. But diplomats did not, foreign secretaries and secretaries of state did not travel around very much in the 1920s, unlike the present. Seems quite unconventional. The Secretary of State is always on the move, and even the president, as we now know, with the climate conference and the G20 conference, the president is always in international travel. But that was not the case in the 1920s. So the likelihood of Kellogg going to Ireland at the invitation of Cosgrave was quite slight, but for the fact that Kellogg had been minister, had been ambassador to Great Britain for several years before becoming Secretary of State, and his senior figure in the London embassy was now the the minister to Ireland, Stirling, was the first U.S. minister to Ireland, and the two families were on very good relations. So there was some personal motivation for going as well, but all of that was interrupted by the the peculiarities of the breakdown of the Anglo-American Japanese cruiser settlement. No agreement was reached. The French and the Italians refused to participate in the negotiations, and the three powers were unable to agree. And Britain and France worked out an arrangement where they would agree to unlimited medium range cruisers of 6,000 tons and guns of 4 to 6 inches, but put limits on heavy cruisers of 10,000 tons and 6 to 8 inch guns, which was what the United States needed because it didn't have a lot of imperial bases around the world. So it needed cruisers that could stay at sea for quite a period of time. And President Coolidge was outraged when this announcement was made without consultation with the United States, and seriously questioned whether Kellogg should go to Paris to sign the agreement, much less trips to London and Ireland. But an arrangement was worked out where Kellogg would go to Ireland, but not to London. And in fact, he would travel on a U.S. cruiser with which the significance could not have been lost. The USS Detroit took Kellogg and Cosgrave, who was urged to come and sign the treaty rather than the Minister of External Affairs. And so Kellogg had a state visit to Dublin. And this is significant because the United States is the only international country, the only sovereign state which had actually recognized the Irish Free State at this point. France and Germany and the Vatican extended diplomatic recognition the following year, 1929. But in 1928, this was the United States was the only country. So here you have the kind of man whose moment in time had arrived. Frank B. Kellogg was a world celebrity in the aftermath of the signing of the Kellogg-Briand Peace Pact. And where does he go? He goes to Dublin and was greeted with open arms and huge parades and freedom of the city and enormous dinners, celebratory dinners. And he ignores Great Britain altogether. It was a clear signal that the United States was not happy about this cruiser arrangement, but it was an enormous boost for Ireland, and particularly in the context of the tensions between the Republicans in Ireland and the supporters of the Irish Free State. The hardcore Republicans continue to argue that the Irish Free State was not the legitimate Irish government, that the second Doyle remained the legitimate government, despite the elections and despite the signing of the treaty and all of this other apparatus. And so this was seen as a strong international endorsement for the legitimacy of the Irish Free State. And that's why I say I'm so surprised that this hasn't been commented on at great length by other historians.
Well, it is. It's a curious episode. And I'm so glad that you unpacked it so well at the end of this book. Now, this has been a lovely conversation, and I'm so grateful for your time and coming to talk about this book. But before I let you go, are you working on anything new at the moment that we can be looking forward to?
Well, not really. I've got an article in circulation on the U.S. the history of the U.S. consulate in Belfast, and which I'd done some writing on previously, trying to use it as an example of the elaborate process of the professionalization of the U.S. consular service, which is useful because the Belfast consulate remained in office in practice from 1796 right up until when I end the paper in 1906. So it remained in functioning during the War of 1812. So you can really kind of trace the development. But that's the only thing. Other than that, COVID has given me an opportunity to review books. So I've been busy reviewing books, which I enjoy doing.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, this has been a conversation with Dr. Francis M. Carroll. His book is America and the Making of an Independent Ireland. You can get your copy now from New York University Press. Francis, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in to this episode of New Books in Irish Studies. Visit newbooksnetwork.com, and there you can browse our library of over 12,000 author interviews covering any subject that your heart could desire. Whatever you're interested in, you're sure to find it there. But that's it for now. I hope you have a great day.